Thank you for joining us here for session 301, Crowdsourcing Our Collections, three case studies of user participation in metadata creation and enhancement. My name is Andrea Medina-Smith. I am the metadata librarian at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where I get to dabble in the archives and do a little bit of this, but not as much as my three colleagues here. In the interest of time, I'm going to very briefly introduce our panelists, and then they will each present, and after all their presentations, I hope we have a rousing Q&A session. So please save your questions for the end. In the wake of the great successes such as Library of Congress on Flickr, the New York Public Library's What's on the Menu project, and HistoryPen, many, many archives have taken the leap into crowdsourcing. Can I see a show of hands of how many people have done a crowdsourcing project in the midst, are thinking about it? I want to see all of them. The impulse to turn to our users, both new and old, and open our collections can take many forms, from transcription to description, accessions to digitization projects. Today, our panel will focus on three different projects to enhance descriptions of collections by users in three different archival settings. Courtney Michael is the digital archivist at Fidelity Corporate Archives. She will be, and previously worked for WGBH in Boston in their media library and archives. She will speak on WGBH's project to enhance their moving image collections through researcher tags and comments. From NARA, Meredith Stewart is a management and program analyst in the Open Government Division. Her presentation looks at how to design a crowdsourcing project for success. And lastly, we have from the Special Collections and University Archives of the University of Iowa is Greg Prickman. Greg will share with us the University of Iowa project to transcribe their collection of Civil War letters and diaries. Without further ado, Courtney Michael.
Thanks. So just briefly, this is what my presentation will cover. I'm going to talk about, give an introduction and talk about an example, one of our collections, so you know what we're dealing with. And then talk through our participatory cataloging project and our plans and designs for that. So just some background, this is who we are. We're the Boston's public television and radio station. We've been producing educational public affairs, children, science, history, drama, and how-to programming since about 1951. We produce fully one-third of the content broadcast on PBS in the U.S., including the series that you see here, as well as many popular children's programs. And in addition to television, we have two radio stations and a large interactive department. The mission of WGBH is to enrich people's lives through programs and services that educate, inspire, and entertain, fostering citizenship and culture, the joy of learning, and the power of diverse perspectives. So I think that crowdsourcing fits very well into that mission. Our archive consists mostly of film, video, and audio tape. We strive to keep as much of the original elements as possible in addition to the finished programming. In many cases, our documentaries have interviewed political leaders, scientists, and artists from around the world. And by keeping as much of these original materials as possible, we have a unique archive of value to scholars and researchers. Some of our favorite highlights of the collection include Julia Child, Eleanor Roosevelt interviewing JFK, Dr. Kenneth Clark interviewing Martin Luther King, James Baldwin, and Malcolm X in 1963, and the Boston Pops conducted by notables such as Arthur Fiedler and John Williams. Our collection is open for research by appointment only, but our primary customers are our producers who reuse our footage and conduct production research. Our catalog is homegrown. It's based on FileMaker right now, and we have a separate and proprietary digital asset management system. Both the digital asset management system and the FileMaker catalog contain metadata harvested from our production process, which means that we have no catalogers, only production assistants and interns who do their best, and our catalog has been spotty at times, and many of our records, especially from earlier eras before we got our Compliance Act in order, are pretty sparse. So just briefly, as an example of some of our holdings that we're trying to get online and digitize, this is Vietnam, a television history. It was a series that aired in 1983, 13 parts, that aimed to tell the story of the war from all perspectives. It was one of the last to be shot and edited on film, and after it aired, the production materials actually went to UMass Boston, University of Massachusetts Boston. But since that time, they remain largely inaccessible to scholars and the general public, and therefore underused. With limited resources or expertise in film materials, little preservation effort happened, and there were no facilities for viewing the film stock or listening to the quarter-inch audio. Access was predominantly limited to paper transcripts, printed records, still images, and a limited collection of work print interviews on VHS. So recognizing the importance of these materials for potential educational use and their deteriorating condition, we entered into a partnership with UMass Boston and with Columbia University to preserve and make accessible the materials, as well as to build teaching environments around them. And this effort was generously funded by the IMLS. So to give you a quick idea of the materials in that collection, the production team shot 103 hours of unique interviews. The interviews include world leaders and decision makers, as well as Vietnamese and American soldiers and civilians. It also includes footage from the time period, as well as footage shot in the late 1970s, early 1980s of post-war Vietnam. Many of these interviews never made the final broadcast program, and it's therefore a goldmine for scholars of the war and its aftermath. So I'm still giving you a little background. This is our website, openvault.wgbh.org. We preserved and digitized the Vietnam material and posted it on our archives website. But even with the large Vietnam collection, this site represents less than 1% of the total holdings in the archive. In general, we've posted items and collections as rights and funding have permitted on this website. And as a result, it's centered around specific topics or television series, and it's not necessarily a representative sample of the larger archive. These are just some of the collections on our Open Vault website, and again, they're grant-funded, so topical or production-based. And once you get into Open Vault, you're searching and encountering materials on an item level. In lieu of finding aids, we've created collection pages with summary information and canned searches to the items in the collection by format or type. The problem, however, is that our collection as a whole is not online, even in a basic finding aid or catalog form. Scholars and researchers must already know something about our content in order to encounter WGBH on the web, the WGBH archives on the web, and then must call the archivist or visit in person to search our catalog. It may as well not exist because it's not available online or discoverable through Google or any union catalogs. So I'm here to talk about our Mellon-funded project to get our catalog out and into the world, and to encourage scholars to use it and contribute metadata back in return. The Mellon Foundation is very interested in scholarly communication in the digital era, and fortunately for WGBH, in the use of media in scholarship. So in 2007, we completed a phase one assessment of our archival collection's value for scholarly use. We found that our biggest strength lay in history, political science, and world history. And following on that, we received funding to continue our investigation and research the questions, how can we help scholars use our archives? How would they want to access our moving image and audio content? And how would they want to use it? A lot of the results from that project went into the Open Vault website that you'll see. So in general, our thinking has been that if it isn't online, it doesn't exist, and I mean either as a metadata record or a digital file. And digitization and web technologies have the possibility to overcome barriers traditionally faced by scholars trying to access moving image and sound collections. So our current project began in 2011, and the aim of this project is to encourage participatory cataloging and expert sourcing, another version of crowdsourcing or a small subset of crowdsourcing, for selection for digitization. And in order to do this, we first need to put our catalog online. So with Open Vault, we have a basic framework for displaying records, but we need to do some design work in order to accommodate plain or media-less records, and to accommodate also a huge increase in the volume of records. It's really going to change our search experience. So I'm just going to walk you through the current framework, which is designed specifically around displaying digitized media. We have our descriptive metadata at the top. I guess you can't really read it, but that's okay. And then cut off on the bottom of the page is the technical metadata. In the center of the page, very prominently, is the media and, where possible, a transcript. The transcript is searchable and synchronized to the media in this case, so you can move back and forth between the video and the transcript. In addition, in our second phase Mellon project, we built annotation and tagging tools. So you can see, you can enter an annotation by time code chunk or add a tag to the record. And while this concept we found has been appealing to scholars, they don't really use it that much. Since we built these a few years ago, we've kind of looked around and felt like many universities and digital humanities centers are building their own tools for scholars to annotate and tag. And a scholar doesn't want to necessarily sign into our website and store their materials or their notes on our website, so they'd rather use their university's tool. So that's what we have so far. That's the basic setup we're working with, and it's all custom built on top of a Fedora repository. So now I'll share with you our plans for encouraging participation from researchers and for opening the catalog to user contributions. For our current project, we'll be posting our catalog online, warts and all, as we say. We'll continue to allow users to tag and annotate as they wish, but also ask for specific metadata if it's missing. We'd like them to help us prioritize for digitization by making requests and by participating in the project on one of three roles that I'll go over in a second. And we'd like for them to use our materials in their scholarship and allow us to harvest their products for metadata to include in our catalog in return. So, if you know anyone, please refer them to us. The three roles that we imagine our scholars can fill represent varying levels of commitment, funding, and time. I'll just go quickly through this because I've got a 5-minute warning. The asset experts will request a certain item, we'll digitize it for them, and then in return we would ask them to fill out a survey or add metadata to the record. Collection curators will take on a larger role and work more directly with the archive to build a collection of materials pertaining to their work and integrate digital humanities tools in their work, and in the process create metadata through their analysis of the materials. And then finally, advisors will help us review that metadata and determine which types of projects and roles are the most productive for both sides of the equation. All three of these roles are an experiment to see how we can invite the most and best participation in our catalog and increase the discoverability of our records. So we've just begun to design an interface for the asset experts to input metadata, and we're thinking it might be useful for more than them. For example, we have many alumni of WGBH who would be excited to contribute data into the catalog without even the exchange of seeing the digitized version. For example, they'll want to add memories or credits and say, I worked on that production, put me in there as a cameraman. So you can see in the upper right a little box that says, can you add information to this record? And then once you click through it, we're planning for a login process. As this, again, is an expert sourcing and we're working very closely with our users, we're thinking it'll open up all of the editable fields for our users to add additional data, sort of like a wiki, except that they can't edit existing data, they can only make additions. Some of the fields will be better served by additions than others. For example, we have pretty good control over our physical information about formats, durations, broadcast standards, etc., but the descriptive metadata is often very lacking. And finally, for those who are not direct participants in the projects, we plan to add a subscribe to this record feature where they can enter their name and email to be notified if and when the item is digitized. This will help us make our selections for digitization based on user demand and also help us recruit partners and collaborators for further projects. So you can see that we're still at the beginning stages of this project and have many decisions left to make about how to incorporate user data, how to mine scholarly work and workflows, and how to sustain these kinds of collaborations with our users. At this point, we're looking for scholars who may be interested in participating or partnering with us while we work to post our catalog online. And while I'm no longer at WGBH, I'm happy to try to answer questions at the end of the session, and I've also included the contact info for the current project manager, Karen Colburn. Thank you.
Good morning. apparently have a frog in my throat. I'm Meredith Stewart. I work for the National Archives. Apparently, I was very ambitious when I came up with this title a year ago. So I'm going to talk about the Citizen Archivist Initiative at the National Archives, and specifically taking a look at our transcription pilot project that we launched in January. So this slide itself is the homepage of our Citizen Archivist dashboard. It's how we approach crowdsourcing at the National Archives. We have a variety of activities for tools and projects, and what we've done is we've kind of created a portal on archives.gov called the Citizen Archivist Dashboard, and that's where we list all of the activities that are available to citizen archivists for crowdsourcing. So what you're going to see at the bottom of the slide is we've got tabs for different tools. So we have tagging, transcription, editing articles, upload and share, indexing the 1940 census, as well as events, contests, and different things that we do throughout the year. So in 2010, the Archivist of the United States, David Ferriero, really began the Citizen Archivist Initiative at the National Archives to create a new role for the public and to really elevate public participation. So what we focus on is substantive contributions from citizen archivists. It can include individual tags, transcripts, like we'll see, and even digital images. And go to the next slide. So here's a list of the activities that we have. And because we have such a wide variety and such a vast collection of materials, we have over 10 billion pages of paper alone, we need a variety of activities. So what we try to do is we try to engage in projects and tools that aren't focused on specific collections, but that can be used for a wide variety of content. And we both do internal and external, so internal meaning on archives.gov or on our own tools, kind of where we control it, as well as participating in other communities. And if you're interested in the great Wikipedia-related activities that we do and our Wikipedian in residence, the session after this one, number 406, is a great session to attend and to learn about what's going on at the National Archives with Wikipedia. So this is the transcription slide, and this is our call to action for people to get started with transcription. When you click on that big button in the middle, start a transcription, you're going to go to a web page where you can choose to either participate in our pilot project or transcribe National Archives records on Wikisource. So this is our homepage for our transcription pilot project. We began development on the transcription pilot less than a year ago, and it launched in January of this year. Our vision for the transcription pilot was to make it as easy and as simple for folks to get started. So what you're going to see when you go to the site, which I encourage you all to do, it's transcribe.archives.gov, is that there's no login. You can click a record and get started with transcribing right away. So on the homepage, you're going to see we have buttons at the top where you can browse documents. You can also search documents. We have tips, FAQs, and policies for additional information for folks. So the information is there and our contact information if they need it, but kind of front and center is your ability to get started and select documents. So you're drawn right away to the images of the documents, and we have a variety of different records we featured here. We've organized them into three categories: beginner, intermediate, and advanced, based on what we perceived the level of difficulty to be in transcribing the document. Beginner documents, as you can imagine, were really, really popular and probably were all transcribed within the first, like, 2 days. And we're like, more people. So beginners were actually really, really popular. As you can expect, intermediate and advanced are harder. In order to feature the documents here on the tool, we had to choose documents that were already transcribed and available in our online catalog. We kind of got lots of recommendations from NARA staff, and some of them were not suitable for transcription. Maybe they were a little bit too, there's a lot of stuff going on, but some of the scans were not good enough when presented with Zoom, and we thought, you know, people would be really challenged. They're not going to be able to make it out in order to transcribe. So higher resolution digital images were really kind of crucial to this project. And we still get some complaints, and some of the images that are lower resolution and difficult to read are in the advanced category. So you can really struggle if you want with advanced documents. So this is one document when you open it up. This is George Washington announcing victory at Yorktown, Virginia. So this is kind of just a screenshot of what you'll see when you click that document or when you click transcribe. And you can see on the right-hand side, we have a link to our catalog. So if you want the more information about this record, you can see it in the context of our catalog. You can see how many pages this record has. We're on page 104, and you can advance to the next page. We do transcription on the tool, but on a page-by-page basis. So we've divided the document up by pages, and then it rolls up to a document level. And then we also have this thing that's very helpful if you're dealing with very large records. You can skip to the next untranscribed page. So we do have some documents that are over 100 pages long. And folks, the first 65 pages may have been completed. And so that's a really nifty tool for you to advance ahead. We also have a zoom, which is crucial in transcribing, on the right-hand side. And when I did testing internally with our staff, it was really interesting to see how people used the Zoom and how different people saw things differently. Just among our own staff, I had them sit down, and I'm sitting behind their shoulder. And it was so great because the first person came in, and they all were selecting the same document on the homepage. So they were all, like, editing each other's work. It was really just so interesting to see how that collaboration, even though they didn't know that they were collaborating with each other, was really improving the transcript. And what was interesting sitting behind them is I actually saw things differently than when I was sitting right in front of the screen. So that was a really interesting thing, like zooming in and out and kind of like even your distance from the screen. You can see we have a simple text field for the transcription. And we have a comments tab. If you tab over, you can enter in comments, which we've seen people use, mostly around discussion of specific words and what they might be, or problems with the transcript. And our call to action is simply to type what you see. So I'm going to go this is actually the same document, but the transcription below, the screenshot below it. And so you can see that this transcription status has been completed, which means that someone has saved this page as complete. And there's no login in our system, but because there's no login, there was a couple things that we needed to do. One, we needed to create a lockout feature so that multiple people wouldn't be overwriting the same page. We didn't have that when we first started, so we got that implemented right away. So this appears red, and it says this page is being transcribed if you do hit it. And then we were getting spammed. So we've implemented a simple CAPTCHA. I know reCAPTCHA would kind of enhance crowdsourcing even further, but we weren't able to implement that. So we have a CAPTCHA that you do it once on the system, and if you stay within the same browser, you don't have to continually re-enter the CAPTCHA. So we really thought that we needed that for spam, to prevent spam, because without a login, we were seeing the actual transcription field getting hit with spam. So this was kind of an important thing for us. And you can see we've put a comment down below because this page was spammed, and we just said that we've restored the transcription. And we do transcription on a page-by-page basis because it's essential for long documents. It breaks up the work, and then you're not going to lose 100 pages of transcription accidentally. It also allows different people to work on the same document at the same time, which is really exciting when you see a 100-page document and 40 of the pages are open and different people are collaborating all at the same time. It's also, transcription is an iterative process on the tool, so we do have folks working on improving mistakes and finishing the document and editing, they can't see it. When it saves, it writes over what was previously there. We do have access from an admin point of view to recall those previous versions, but it's not apparent to the user. So the way that a user would get in touch with us is to email us or put it in the comments that you know they need it kind of reverted back to an original. And we're exploring how to make these transcripts available in our catalog. There's a lot of challenges with that, but that's certainly kind of where we'd like to head, is to you know continue to grow our catalog with the transcripts that have been done. It's also kind of important to note that we're approaching transcription from a web accessibility standpoint rather than what might be a traditional transcription for historical publication. So that's why one of the reasons why we've decided to go with the free text field as opposed to other tools that have editing, encoding buttons, and things like that. These are our transcription tips. So we've simply asked folks to type what they see, and we've made some tips as to what we'd like them to do, which includes transcribing in a way that makes sense for the document, especially given the limitations of the tools without those editing features, to not worry about formatting because of the lack of editing features, to use illegible in brackets when they can't make out a word, which really kind of is awesome because you can search the tool for illegibles. So if you are someone who is particularly good at reading handwriting and you want to challenge yourself, I encourage you to go in the search box and type illegible, and it's pretty fun. And for folks that want to make notations about what's on the document, we encourage them to do that and to do so in brackets. So from these few tips, we've seen a lot of interesting things. This image is a Russian document. It's the Alaska Purchase Treaty. It's in multiple languages, Russian, French, and English. And this got up there. We didn't like say, oh, we want to see what happens, it just because it was on our list. And it has Cyrillic characters. And we did not expect anyone to transcribe Cyrillic, and they did. So if you see down below, you see actually the Cyrillic characters, which is quite interesting because our tool doesn't actually support Cyrillic. So someone has used their own tools and copied and pasted it into the free text field, which is pretty amazing. So some other interesting things is that people are really taking ownership over the documents. One person might think is completely transcribed might mean something else to us, like completely transcribed. We think, you know, lots of people have looked at it. Some folks have kind of taken the approach that, oh, well, I finished it. It's finished. So we've also noticed we've put some comments on pages where we thought more things needed to happen, and within the next day, someone had actually gone in and done what we've indicated. The transcript wasn't complete. So it was really exciting, all without a login. And another really interesting thing, I just came across this week, in the diary of Robert E. Perry, it's over 100 pages from 1909, handwritten. And in the front, there's a calendar, like a diary page. And so what you see is someone has actually indicated for each number, whether it was crossed off or blackened out, or I mean, the painstaking detail someone has taken to indicate exactly what was on that page without any editing tools is pretty amazing. So we're still trying to figure out, you know, where we want to go with this. It is a pilot project, and it was a huge proof of concept for us. It was incredibly successful. Within the first 2 weeks, we featured over 300 documents representing over 1,000 pages, and within 2 weeks, almost all of those had moved from completely transcribed to partially transcribed. So everything had been touched and worked on. Because of that, we actually didn't do a lot of publicity, so I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't really hear about it, because we realized very soon we didn't have enough content to really satisfy the interest of users. So with a few tweets, we got all of that work done, and it's been really exciting for us at the agency. Looking forward, we actually developed this tool based on Drupal. And so we'll have an open source module that we will make available on Drupal probably in September, and we're calling it Transcriber. We'd love to feature new documents and collections on the transcription pilot and kind of take it to the next level and see where we can go with this. In the future, these are kind of our wish list of things. We'd love to try to do crowdsourced review a little bit better in the tool, with more specific instructions for checking spelling and spelling mistakes, making sure that you've gotten the spelling mistake correct in the transcription. And we'd love to work with APIs so that this transcription tool could be built off of our catalog and kind of feed back in more automatically. So thank you very much.
Okay. Well, our foray at the University of Iowa into crowdsourcing began when the digitization of our Civil War collections was completed. So in 2009, we made a commitment to digitize all of our Civil War era manuscript material with the goal of launching a digital collection by the start of the sesquicentennial in 2011. So when it was clear by the summer of 2010 that it was looking good that we were on target to complete this. Then we started thinking, well, how can we enhance the project, take it beyond another static digital collection? So with thousands of newly created images of handwritten text, transcription seemed to have the most potential for making the material more usable. By choosing to employ crowdsourcing for the transcription, we were operating under the assumption that Civil War material would draw a built-in audience of enthusiasts who would be happy to help make the material more accessible. So our approach to all this was driven by our resources, which for this really amounted to basically nothing, nothing beyond our everyday infrastructure. We didn't have a budget for a crowdsourcing project. We didn't have any special software or systems in place. We didn't develop anything. We didn't actually even get approval from library administrators to pursue the project. We just kind of gave it a shot. So I went to our webmaster and asked if there was any way that we could make a page that would allow people to enter transcriptions to the images. I mean, that can't be too hard, right? Well, she's kind of hemmed and hawed, and I think that's not going to work. We're going to need something else to do that. It's not possible. So I went away and thought, well, maybe someday, you know, we'll have a chance to put something like this in place. Well, shortly thereafter, huge screen, very small image, so you can't really read it. But shortly thereafter, she emailed a rough version in this link said, take a look. If we want to pursue this, we can maybe do something like this. Well, the site that we have today is essentially exactly what she sent. What this first rough draft was. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. It basically uses a little bit of PHP code to pull images out of ContentDM, which is where we have all of the images stored. The transcription is entering the text into an email form, and you email that. When you submit the transcription, it gets emailed to an inbox. At that point, a human being checks it against the original image. And then it gets added to the Content DM record. So this is the view in Content DM. This is the end of the process with the image of the document, the full text field under page description. That's where the text goes that was entered and emailed off of the transcription site. So that's it. We launched the site in May 2011, announced it through the usual channels, press releases, blog entries, etc. And it was fairly quiet after we launched the site. But then things started to pick up when a summer intern in our digital unit sent a link to the project to the American Historical Association. And they did a blog entry on it. The lesson here is always be nice to the interns, okay? Because after this, it started to appear on a few other blogs. Soon after that, someone posted it on reddit.com under the title, "Today I Learned How to Participate in History While Sitting on My Ass by Transcribing Civil War Diaries Online." And so suddenly we went viral. The site had over 30,000 page views by 3 o'clock p.m. that day. At one point, we were receiving up to 80 simultaneous hits on the server. This pretty much, of course, sunk the servers. And so our little under-the-radar project, you know, we're just going to kind of try this, suddenly, you know, came to the attention of the server administrators. And but that was okay, you know. I think, you know, it's like a room like this. If the fire marshal gets involved because you have too many people, that's usually a good thing, right? Because you want a good turnout. So as things settled down then, in about 48 hours or so, we faced the task of sorting through all of those emailed entries. And surprisingly, they were almost entirely of a high quality. And then since then, we've had a good steady rate of participation. So as of earlier this week, 14,759 pages have been transcribed. And that represents just about all of the Civil War material. And we rolled this out kind of slowly in the sense that we started off, we were just going to do the diaries. And then people blew through all the diaries. Well, actually, we started with a selection of diaries. When that started to proceed quickly, we added the rest of the diaries. And then we added in all of the correspondence. All the manuscript letters. So now what's feeding the site, we have that same problem of feeding the beast. We've been adding additional Civil War collections that have come in to the department since the site was launched because the publicity surrounding it then caused people to get in touch saying, I have diaries and letters. And so what we tell people now, especially with Civil War material, is that if people are interested in donating the material, it will be digitized. It will be digitized fairly quickly, and it will be added to this site. So that's what, if you go to the site today, that's what you'll see is mostly stuff that's come in since the project was begun. But of course, that will be exhausted soon. It's not like, you know, we're getting all sorts of stuff every day. So we're now working on an upgrade to the site to include other collections. So this fall, we're going to be relaunching it with manuscript cookbooks from the 17th through the 20th century. So I think at this point, in a project like this, we've learned a few things. So a couple of observations. This is some recent Google Analytics of the site. That spike is reddit.com. That kind of speaks for itself. I think what's more interesting in some ways is everything that comes after that. You see these little bumps along the way. And that's been that kind of steady, solid participation that we've seen ever since. So I think the lesson there is that not all viral events are created equal. It was great and exciting to have the server taken down by a huge response. But a viral fever burns out. So I think our real success has come from the kind of viral experience. It's like a bad cold. It's not too severe, but it hangs around, it won't go away, and it's really easily passed from one person to another. So, I mean, this project in internet years isn't necessarily the latest or greatest thing anymore, but it still gets mentioned on Twitter and retweeted around, every few weeks we get these sort of bursts of new activity, and we've had some good results from other social media as well. Again, a little bit difficult to see, but on Pinterest, somebody, we had put a few things from the digital library on Pinterest, and somebody pinned the transcription site and said, "Finding this on Pinterest pushed me over the edge to join. I don't know which is better, getting to see the original manuscripts or the privilege of helping to transcribe them." So I think another lesson that we've learned is that most of our transcribers are not what you would consider the stereotypical Civil War buff, which, again, that was our assumption going in, is we had probably a built-in audience for this. We've had participation from people all over the world. We've heard anecdotes of people hearing about one of their Facebook friends discovering the project, and then they go check it out, thinking, "I'll just try one or two pages." And they end up spending the whole night transcribing. And these are people who have no particular dedication to Civil War history, specifically. One of our power transcribers, who now emails us regularly about the project, is actually a retiree from the northwest of England. He read about crowdsourcing in the Sunday Times and got intrigued and went online to search for a project that he could participate in. So he thought ours was about the English Civil War. and he plunged right in. Well, he's now transcribed more than anyone else. And I think it also of note is the words used by the transcriber here on Pinterest, that it's a privilege to help transcribe. I think it can be easy to forget, when we all have all the access we could ever want in our jobs, what it means to people to be a part of something they ordinarily feel excluded from. I think in a way, the simplicity of the site too, there's a lack of community on the site, which is counterintuitive these days in a lot of ways. But I think that we're not trying to build a community for specialists that already have their own online communities and networks. And I think that that lack of community really enhances the intimacy of the experience of reading and working on the documents. So why do people get hooked? I think one of the lessons we've learned is the appeal of narrative. People get hooked on the stories they're reading as they transcribe, and the element of participation seems to mean that they are reading in an engaged manner that is much different than just sitting someone down and saying, "Read this digitized diary online." Even the most ordinary accounts bring people in contact with the past, and when there are real consequences of the war, when people are injured or are killed and don't return to the family they've been writing to, the transcribers are affected emotionally. So, as our friend Dave from England wrote, "These people come alive. You come to share their hopes, their fears, their everyday concerns, the price of food for themselves and for their animals, the cost of doctor's visits, their illnesses, and sadly, their deaths. Yes, you do become absorbed in the people, and losing them is like losing a relative or a friend." So this is a much different experience, I think, than contributing data to a crowdsourcing project, just, you know, simple raw data. I mean, that can also be a very rewarding experience, but I think that narrative element is quite likely one of the reasons why a smaller scale project like ours has received the attention and participation that it has. So now that the project is over a year old, thousands of pages have been transcribed, we're at a transitional point in its evolution. It needs to expand to continue, and the success of the approach has already begun to affect our digitization plans. We're now well underway with the scanning of our manuscript cookbooks and recipe books, which are drawn from our Zathmary culinary collection. And now we're implementing Scripto to enable a more robust process for managing all the transcriptions. So this will enable us to have multiple transcription streams, and then we'll be able to continue to refine the original Civil War transcriptions so that we can crowdsource the other activities, like normalizing spelling and editing of the language to make searching better, correcting and proofreading it, et cetera. So that's all great. But I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind moving forward that we're trying to work into this is to not lose sight of the simplicity, which I think is what you're facing as well, that having no barriers to participation, when you find the page, you start. You don't have to log in. There's no barrier to getting started. That's what gets people hooked. And I think in a way, depending on what we put into the system, we may in some cases be transitioning away from the narrative aspect. So again, you know, you can make the assumption that with manuscript cookbooks, there's a built-in audience, but that's not really where the success came from with the Civil War material. So time will tell, I think, how well something like recipes appeals to just sort of the casual foodie, or maybe someone who isn't necessarily interested in the specifics at all, but likes to participate in the process. So, you know, we'll see. So I think for me, the lesson of crowdsourcing that we've learned is that, like many things that blossom online as if they were something completely new, is that really we're reinforcing some very traditional principles. And the main one being that volunteers contribute really valuable time, expertise, and efforts to our endeavors. There's really nothing new in that. The proof of concept is that something like crowdsourced transcription the proof of concept is that something like crowdsourced transcription provides user-generated content that can be a valuable enhancement to the materials. And I think if that's the case, if we're at that point where we think that user-generated content does have a lot of value and is important, then how do we get away from transcription project site or crowdsourcing project site and build this into everything that we do? So that we can integrate that participation into all of our efforts. How do we create online resources that invite and actively seek and encourage user content just as a matter of course, something expected, taken for granted? I think this is a shift in perspective that can influence all of our activities. And that's true online, it's true offline as well. We've begun an outreach event that allows participants to spend time browsing through a selection of books from the Rare Book Collection and writing down tags and descriptive information that we can then add to the item's record. And so if we focus on some of the lesser known items in our collection, we're generating interest in material that's easily overlooked, and attendees then feel as though they have greater access to rare material than they would in a traditional exhibition. And I think we're getting back to that idea of it's a privilege to experience this material in a new way. I think that's really important. Same approach could happen in a classroom setting when students are examining documents. I think one of the arguments of something like crowdsourcing is that, you know, undergraduates can contribute valuable information just like anyone else can. So in conclusion, I think just try. That's really one of the lessons that we learned. You know, use the resources you have if you can, see what happens. You might be surprised, as we were surprised. Keep things simple, just as simple as you can, and make what we're doing about participation, work that into everything that we do. Thank you.
All right, so the session is being recorded, so if you can please speak up, and I will repeat whatever questions we have for our speakers. In the front? So the question is, not having a login is for the ease of use and reducing barriers, but do any of the regular users want to have the ability to get credit for the work they've done or have a byline? Is there anything in place that you could do that with?
So for us as a national archives, for our transcription tool, not having a login, we've heard from folks that do want logins and want some credit. So potentially if we were to implement a login in the future, that would be an option, but you wouldn't have to log in to get started. Maybe that's, you know, what you would do as kind of an advance. So you're already hooked at that point, so then you want to log in and kind of get more features.
We haven't had any, I haven't heard anyone express that interest that they'd like to see that. I think that what we've found is that, you know, I mentioned our friend from England. I mean, we know about him because he takes us beyond just the transcription element and actually gets in touch because there's a contact link. And I think there are certain people that we know are doing a lot of transcribing, and we don't necessarily know who they are unless, in his case, he tells us. So it would have some value for us in the sense that as people become very familiar with the material, they've gone through a lot of it, we can enfranchise them to take over some of the responsibility for the cleanup and the editing and all that, people who really have their hands in it. And I think there would be some value to the project in that.
If I could just add really quickly, I think we have like a heavy plans for a login and real review by archivists, and it's not really, I don't want to use the term free for all, but it's not easy to participate in our project. But I think some of that has to do with rights and all those fun things. But a lot of it is also thinking about incentive, and I think that's something to think about if you're starting a crowdsourcing project. Besides transcription, I've seen some games where people are tagging things and they can get points or win prizes. So there's all different ways. And for our project, the incentive is scholarly publication and credit. So yeah, there's all different levels of that.
Green sweater in the back. So the question is, well, it's actually a request for comment, I guess, on what sort of processes you have in place for quality control, how much happens behind the scenes within the archives, and how much happens on the user end.
Well, in our case, as I mentioned, we have somebody actually checks through everything that's submitted, and now there's pros and cons to that. Obviously, having a human being in the process assures a certain amount of quality control. It also is staff time when they could be doing something else. We've had people from our cataloging department, from the digital library department doing that kind of work. It is metadata enhancement, ultimately. That is the goal. So having the metadata, the people who are already working with the metadata all day long anyway, it makes sense that that's a part of their duty. So as you're transcribing and you submit the entry, it doesn't just pop up into the record. There is an intermediate step. And I think that's worked out pretty well at this point. Now, how that scales up, again, we're at a point where we start to figure some of that out, especially as we're doing multiple streams of different types of documents.
So for our transcription tool, we're really kind of in the midst of figuring this all out. So we have the tips on the tool, and we've seen some really interesting things, but we're in the process of trying to figure out, you know, is there one right way of doing transcription for our agency, or can we accept a degree of variability in how folks approach transcription? The National Archives has never transcription, it's not really part of our role. So kind of thinking forward, we don't really see transcripts, at least those that would live in our online catalog, as ever being completed, but that they could be continually refined and edited by community. So if someone comes along and happens to be an expert in Notion and can transcribe Cyrillic, the next person might not come along for years, and we'd love to keep it open so that that continual improvement could happen. It's not possible for us to review every transcript, and we know that, and that is so. What we're trying to do is figure out ways to successfully crowdsource the review and the refinement, and how to build tools and you know, make it really easy for folks to do that.
Do you have something to add?
No, just quickly, I think ours is a little different just because it's more expert sourcing and more sheltered from the masses. So we're building more of a one-on-one trust relationship with our users. Not that you don't trust your users, but, you know, a direct, we know who they are.
Louder next time.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to mention educational
I got to repeat the question. So the question is, do you see these tools and collections being used by younger students, younger than undergraduates, middle school, high school, sort of to catch their imagination on history?
Yes, and I think that's already happened in some cases. And certainly in terms of undergraduate coursework, we've had a couple of instances already where someone's going to bring a class in to look at the original documents, but before they come in, they have the students do transcription so that they're familiar with what they're going to be looking at in a completely different way, then they get the experience of coming in and using the original. That's something that absolutely very easily could expand to other grades, other settings, definitely.
The question is, do some of the, are the scans all at NARA done in-house, or are they third-party scans which you're working off of for the transcription?
Our catalog includes both. The vast majority of the third-party scans from external providers will come soon, but the majority of the images in the catalog right now are in-house produced. Actually, we also have a large, ever-growing born electronic images and digital copies within our catalog. So.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. So let me see if I've got your question correctly. Does the transcription process lead to more use of the collection? Are users being attracted to use that collection because they are transcribed now?
Not at the moment, because those transcriptions need to go back into our catalog. But they are immediately searchable on the tool right now, which is incredibly interesting. So you can start searching, and already you're seeing different ways of getting into those documents. So if you just go into the search box on the transcription tool and search for some things, it's incredibly interesting. And that's what's going to fuel the greater search capabilities within the National Archives. We just have to get all the systems talking together, which is very difficult.
All right, and last question in the green blouse. The question is, how did the University of Iowa Special Collections handle the workflow and the workload spike after the collection went viral and the project went viral?
Well, that all happened in the summer. So the person that we had assigned to check the inbox when the Reddit posting went up, she was gone on vacation for 2 weeks. So, you know, one thing that's good about this is that all this is happening behind the scenes. If you're going to transcribe something, you have no idea really what happens to it once you submit it, which nobody really seems to mind. I don't know. But what that means is that we can work through them at our own pace, really. I think we had about 6,000 transcriptions as a result of the Reddit event. And there wasn't any particular drain on staff or anything. We just kind of steadily worked through it. There are other periods when it's much quieter, and in those periods, it gives you a chance to catch up on these times when, for whatever reason, it gets circulated around again, and you can see another little spike in activity.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'm sure that the speakers are available afterwards if you have any more questions.